Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hey, everybody. Bienvenidos, bienvenidas. Welcome back to New Books in Latin American Studies. This is Pamela Fuentes, the host of the channel. Today we'll be talking to Antonio Gasparetto Jr. about his new book, Atmósfera de Plomo, Las Declaraciones de Estado de Sitio en la Primera República Brasileña, which could be something like Lead Atmosphere, the Declarations of State of Exception during the First Brazilian Republic. This book was published by Tirant LoBlanche in 2019. Antonio, welcome to the show.
Thank you for the opportunity, and I'm very glad to be here.
Antonio, I wonder if you could begin the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, sure. I am a Brazilian. I live in Juiz de Fora, in Brazil, and I work as a professor at a master's degree at the Federal University of Juiz de Fora. And I am a postdoctoral fellow at São Paulo University too, in Brazil. So I researched about the state of exception and the state of siege specifically during all my PhD, the development of my PhD thesis. And I had a period of studying and researching at Sorbonne University too, in Paris.
Thank you. And tell us how you came to write Atmosfera de Plomo. What's the story behind the interest that moved you to write this book?
Well, actually, when I was researching for my master's degree, I saw some specific commentaries on those papers of the first Brazilian First Republic, that is a period from 1889 until 1930, where the state of siege appeared a lot of times in newspapers. And I realized that no one else had studied it before, had researched about it. So I realized that it was a big gap in historiography and in Brazilian history about the First Republic and about the Republic itself, because it's a subject that is not very well explored in Brazil yet. So I decided to investigate it deeper and understand it, how it worked in the First Republic and how it worked to construct Brazilian democracy and the Brazilian Republic. So I discovered that it was used many more times than I imagined. And it is clearly a very important point of the first Brazilian experience in a republican system. So all the Brazilian First Republic was constructed dealing with the state of siege, a specific characteristic of that period. And it influenced a lot the construction of democracy and republic in my country.
And for those that might not be familiar with, including myself, of course, even if I read your book already, but can you introduce us to the broad context of the First Brazilian Republic? As you mentioned, you explored the years of 1889 to 1930, and there are several changes in power, a constant struggle between authoritarianism and social mobilization. But what would you say are the highlights we should keep in mind to follow the stories you explain in your book?
Yes, in fact, Brazilian First Republic started in 1889, as you said, and it was the consequence of the end of the monarchy in Brazil that became independent in 1822 as a monarchy country. Until 1889, it was governed by two kings that we call Dom Pedro the First and Dom Pedro the Second. The monarchy ends in 1889 with a coup that started the Republican period with a military government of Deodoro da Fonseca, that actually was a friend of the king before, but it was part of the coup. And this period lasted until 1930, when another coup ended the First Republic, and the power went to Getúlio Vargas, one of the most famous Brazilian presidents of all time. And during this period, called the First Republic, we have the clear power of the oligarchies in Brazil, constructed by the farmers that lived in created a economic condition of Brazilian economy based on coffee. This product. So it was the main product of Brazilian First Republic, for all these years, 41, this period of 41 years. And this product ruled all the circumstances about this first Brazilian experience in a republican system. So it was controlled by the farmers that produced the coffee, and it was controlled by some states, especially São Paulo and Minas Gerais were very strong political actors in that period. But of course, we had many others in our nation that participated and played in this game of the First Republic too. But we can highlight them as main actors that contributed to construct these oligarchies in the First Republic. So it is different of the other Brazilian republican periods, because we have this concentration of power around the farmers and around some specific states that controlled the political system and the economical system in Brazil.
And throughout your book, you provide a rich history of the concept of state of exception, as well as its consequences in practice. We will talk about some of those changes more in depth during this interview, but can you briefly define this concept? And maybe we can take this chance for you to explain, why did you use the phrase atmosfera de plomo, let atmosphere, as part of the title of your book?
Yes. Well, so state of siege, as I mentioned before, that was very used in Brazil, is a constitutional institution that was created by the French people during the French Revolution in the end of the 18th century, specifically at in 1791, in the first French constitution. State of siege in that time referred to a military technique to use in war, to use in battles. But with the years, this institute became used to be applied to revolts, some insurrections in French too, and French people and the French governments discovered that this constitutional institute could be used to apply against the French people, not just against the enemy, the foreign enemy, but against the French people. Well, this constituted this notion of a state of exception. But a state of exception is not a creation of the French Revolution. This is a concept that we use talking about ancient Rome, for example, and that period. But this was a new signification of a state of siege, dealing with a state of exception. Well, so I tried to deal with it too, apply these concepts of state of exception and state of siege in Brazil, because I realized that they appeared so much during this specific period I call First Republic, and the historiography too call it First Republic. I called my book Atmosfera Diploma, or Led Atmosphere, because this was an expression used by a parliamentarian during the First Republic to describe this heavy context that existed in Brazil during the First Republic, especially during the government of Artur Bernardes. During Artur Bernardes' government, it was at the period in First Republic when the state of siege lasted the longest. So almost 4 years of the state of siege. It means that he governed almost during a state of exception, with many crazy acts too, but with authoritarianism, as you said. So all these elements contributed to be described by this Brazilian parliamentary as a led atmosphere. And I chose this phrase, this expression, to be the title of my book because it synthesizes very well what happened in Brazil in that moment.
And one of the aspects I enjoy the most about your book are the transnational connections you analyzed. In the first chapter, as you are already explaining to us, you explore the long history of state of exceptions, starting by Roman law, but mainly focusing on France and the Revolution. Just for us to be in the same boat, why is it important to explore the French case?
Well, it's very important to explain to understand the French case, because it is the cradle of this constitutional institute called the state of siege as a constitutional institute, because the concept of state of exception is older from Roman law, as you said too. But the constitutional institute was created during the French Revolution, so it was after the first French constitution that this institute started to be used in France and then in other countries in Europe, and then it came to Latin America, especially to Chile, and after Argentina, and then Brazil, and then Colombia too. And it gained a big repercussion in Latin America, adapted to all the constitutions in all the countries that were born in Latin America in the 19th century, in the first half of the 19th century. So it is important. I wanted, my intention was to explore the condition of the creation of this institute to understand why or why not it was transferred to Brazil, and to Latin America, and what were the relations between the original institute created in France and the uses that Latin American countries were doing in 19th century. So that was the point and why I needed to do these international connections.
And just a piece of information that I'm curious about, that's kind of a personal question I have, and I hope my our audience find it interesting. But you mentioned that in 1851, even the famous motto, liberty, equality, and fraternity, was suppressed as part of state of siege measures. Can you tell us more about this?
Yes. So during the uses of state of siege in France, it started as a military institution to use it in wars, as I said, but then it became a very strong institute to repress the riots and all the kinds of insurrections that happened in France. So governance explored this authoritarianism characteristic in French society, used this institute to repress in many circumstances, including the one that you said, that is they were not allowed to use anymore the French most famous expression, because it was a demonstration of an insurgency against the government, and the state of siege was there to it, an institute to repress all kinds of insurgents in France.
Very interesting. Okay, let's move to the Brazilian context now. You explore the 1891 constitution against the backdrop of other constitutions at the time. What are the transnational exchanges between the Brazilian constitution and other debates in neighboring countries like Argentina or Colombia that you were already introducing to the conversation?
Well, we have to identify first that in 1891, the constitution of 1891 in Brazil is the first Brazilian Republican constitution too, and actually our second constitution, because the first one was formed from the monarchy period in 1824. And before I started to look to other constitutions or constitutions of other countries in Latin America, or even French constitutions, I looked to the first Brazilian constitution from 1824, from the monarchy, to search for any aspect of a state of siege or a state of exception in that text, constitutional text. And I discovered that the expression state of siege was not there. Yeah, so they didn't use the state of siege as an expression that clear appeared in this text. But they had some aspects of exceptional measures to deal with riots and some other aspects, other crises in Brazilian monarchy. Well, so after that, I had to look to constitutions of other countries, because the reference of Brazilian constitution of 1891 was not in Brazilian constitution of 1824. It was in other countries' constitutions, so especially in Chilean constitution and Argentina's constitution, because they used this expression, a state of siege, and they used the institute a lot in their governments, in their political crises. In that time, I realized that they were actually an inspiration to Brazilian context in the end of 19th century, because they saw that they were using the power, and especially the emergency power, to deal with a crisis, and especially political crisis, in our neighbors, in Chile and in Argentina. And the Brazilian parliamentarians in that time imagined that that condition of power to the president, so emergency powers to the president, to the executive power, was the key to deal with these aspects, this crisis that were happening in Latin America and other countries in Latin America. And Brazil could use that tool, that institute to deal with crisis in our country. So it was inserted for the first time, clearly inserted for the first time in Brazilian Constitution in 1891. And when other countries already used in Latin America, already used a lot of state of siege in many cases, Brazil was starting to use. So Brazil arrived late in uses of state of siege in Latin America. But it lasted long until the end, until the end of the First Republic in 1930. Of course, they didn't stop to use it in other countries like Argentina, Chile, and Colombia, as you mentioned. But Brazil arrived late in this aspect, in this use of emergency powers and a state of exception. In this Latin American context.
In the third chapter, you explore the administrations of the first three presidents of the First Republic. And in this and the following chapters, we start getting a sense of the, if I'm allowed to say, the human dimension of the state of exception measures, how the lives of Brazilians who opposed the government in different ways were affected by this state of siege. You analyze different cases, but could you talk a little bit about the dissent against mandatory vaccination? I couldn't help but having that in my brain while I was reading. So please, can you tell us more about that?
Sure. And unfortunately, nowadays, the vaccination is a problem again in Brazil.
Interesting. We can talk a little bit about that too.
In the First Republic, we had a riot about vaccination because it was mandatory, as you said, and people didn't agree with it. And some parliamentarians in Brazil stimulated the people not to agree with the mandatory vaccination. So it became a real insurrection with a conflict against the public forces in Brazil. And in this context, state of siege specifically was not used to repress this kind of people, this group of people that were contesting the vaccination. State of siege in this case, was used to repress another coup that was in progress. So there were some parliamentarians again that were trying to make another one in Brazil to take the power, the executive power. As many cases of state of siege in the First Republic, they were declared to repress all these possibilities of coups to take the executive power. And I divide it in three moments, as you probably saw in the book. I divided it in different moments because they were different actors that were trying to do it. And in this moment of the vaccination crisis during the government of Rodrigues Alves in 1904, there was another try of a coup. That was the reaction of the government, was very strong against people, common people, folk people, so they used the power to repress, but especially they used the power and the emergency powers, the state of exception and the clearly state of siege, to repress and arrest these those people that were trying to get the executive power to them.
And in chapter 4, you define the period between 1910 and 1918 as an interlude that you call a lament for the spilled blood of underprivileged Brazilians. In particular, you explore the episode of some sailors who revolt against the government. How does this case embody the use of state of siege as a mechanism to repress opposition and citizens and affecting underprivileged groups in Brazil?
This case you mentioned specifically is a highlight of the First Republic to demonstrate this mechanism to repress the citizens. Because, as you said, the sailors were part of a very poor group of society. And especially in the First Republic in Brazil, the sailors were the group where were the slavery ended in Brazil in 1888, but black people, Negroes, that they call it in the First Republic, couldn't find a job because people didn't want to hire them as workers now. So they had this difficult to find jobs. And the only place that they could find the jobs in Brazilian capital, that was Rio de Janeiro in that time, was in the marine as sailors. So they did the worst kind of work in this institution, and they received many punishments and physical punishments yet. In Brazil. Brazil was the last country in the world to abolish the physical punishment to sailors. So in that time of state of siege against the sailors, they were manifesting their insatisfaction with that condition, and they just asked more conditions of better life conditions. So they wanted to receive a payment, a regular payment for their works. They wanted to be treated as humans, because they weren't yet. It was a consequence of the long slavery process in Brazil. Brazil was the last country in the Occidental world to end the slavery. So this characteristic is part of our society until today, with many problems. Imagine in the beginning of the 20th century, with 20 years of the end of slavery, it was very, very present in that time, in that society. So this state of siege case was around this it was dealing with this situation of a racist society without opportunities to everyone, a society of inequalities. That was the characteristic of the First Republic too in Brazil. That people, or those people, rights. They didn't have rights. They weren't treated as real humans yet, and they were asking for it. It was not an insurrection against the government. It was not an insurrection against to take the executive power, as many other cases in the First Republic where people tried a coup. No, they were just asking for better conditions, for a better life, because they still didn't have.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And I think it's in that chapter. So far we have been talking about the use of this legal tool to repress opponents of the government, but that's the time of the First World War. And it was also used with the argument to avoid external threats to Brazil, right? How was that? How's the use of the state of siege when dealing with the possibility of external enemies or external threats?
In Brazilian Brazilian Constitution of the First Republic, state of siege could be used in two situations, against foreign threats and against internal threats. So in almost all the cases, or I can say in all the cases excepting this one, state of siege was used against Brazilian people and a Brazilian crisis. But that was the only time when state of siege was used to answer to the second possibility of the rules in constitution against an external crisis, against war, in a situation of war. Brazil didn't go to first war, that was called the Great War at the time. Brazil didn't go as a fighter like the United States or some European countries. Brazil entered late to, arrived late in the First World War, and just with some medical expeditions to help countries that were fighting against Germany in that moment. But state of siege was used here as a condition to declare that Brazil was in a condition of war, was facing an external crisis that could lead us to a worse condition. But fortunately, it didn't happen in Brazil. Actually, we just had some ships that were attacked by the Germans, and that's why Brazil entered the First World War, and our participation in that conflict was small. In the Second World War, Brazil participated as a fighter in battles, actually. So, and that was the only case in the First Republic when the state of siege was used against the external threats.
And now that we have all this rich context, I would like to ask you about people in positions of power speaking against the state of exception. Was that the case in different moments in history, like legislators or people openly talking about how dangerous this was, or we have other actors like the press talking about that, or who are those talking against this in a context that is so dangerous to openly talk against the state of siege?
State of siege specifically is not an exceptional institute that is so present or constant nowadays. But a state of exception as a bigger concept is here, actually. It's here nowadays, especially because of the coronavirus crisis. The pandemic is creating conditions of exceptions in many countries in the world. And if we think about the concept of the state of exception and all the possibilities to suspend some rights and some laws and some constitutional other rights, norms, rules, we are dealing with a state of exception. It's not it's not uncommon to talk about the state of exception today. It is more common than uncommon, unfortunately. The pandemic created a specific scenario to be like that. But before the pandemic, state of exception was already present in many countries in the world because of many circumstances. We can mention, for example, one of the most recent circumstances that influenced the declarations of institutes that represent a state of exception because of the terrorism in the United States, for example, after 9/11, 2001, when the President George Bush used some emergency powers and some exceptional measures to deal with the threat of terrorism. The same case happened in France, again, returning to the country that created the Institute State of Siege. It happened in France, too, because of terrorism, again, in 2015 with that great attack that killed many people in Paris, and I was there that time. When I was researching for my PhD, I was researching the state of exception, and I lived the state of exception there because of a terrorist attack on November of 2015. It was terrible. But
I cannot even imagine.
It was really terrible, and this is one of the cases we can mention that state of exception is a common institute in our lives. But if we return some more years or decades in Latin America, for example, we can mention the example of Colombia fighting against the narcos,
drug dealers.
Yes, thank you. Drug dealers. And then in Argentina, where the state of exception was used because of economic crisis and created this possibility to, in 2001, for example. And now, very recent, in 2019. Ecuador and Colombia again, they were using measures, exceptional measures, or even states of exception, using this term, this expression, against economical crisis again and against riots to control and repress people in their countries. So a state of exception, in my point of view, is a research that is necessary for our times. There is a very important German philosopher that is called Ginter Frankenberg, that says that the state of exception is being used, and we are admitting to miss some rights in our defenses. That's the case of terrorism, for example. We admit to lose some rights, constitutional rights, to defend ourselves, to defend our countries. Well, I like a lot what his book from Ginter Frankenberg, because George Agamben is not the only one that talks about the state of exception, but George Agamben is the Italian philosopher that is the most famous. Everyone knows and uses his ideas and talks to him with his ideas of state of exception. And he was very important to focus this aspect of political life again, returning to Carl Schmitt and returning to Walter Benjamin. But we have now in this century, 21st century, we have new works dealing, new researches dealing with the state of exception, because it is becoming more and more part of our lives. And all the parliamentary actors in the world, in many countries, are using this expression in their speeches. So that demonstrates how it is important to deal with it, to research about it, and to understand it better, because it is now I will use what George Agamben says, it is an empty of law, a hole where we don't know what happens, because there are laws but there aren't laws, and we live in a context with laws without laws, and it's very complex, and this is the point where we have threats to enforce the executive power and to create conditions to develop and spread the authoritarianism in the world.
You know, like now with this conversation, I think we can get a sense of what's happening with your book, because your book offers an interesting balance between legal history but also the consequences that legislation has in daily lives. So before finishing our conversation, I want to ask you, is there any story that made an impact of you while writing this book during your research, whether you include this story in your book or not, like a particular moment during your research that actually took some time from you to think or rethink what you were working on at the time?
Oh, sure. Because during my researches, I could discover and I could identify many violations of human rights in Brazil. And we are talking about a period in a democratic system, in a republican system, but as I said, we are talking about an exception that is a context of laws without laws. And so the governments in that time committed many acts of violation of human rights, and nothing happened to them, to Brazilian presidents from the First Republic. So I could identify all these characteristics, and I could identify numbers of crimes too that happened in Brazil, numbers of deaths of common people that were killed by the state in Brazilian First Republic, mm-hmm. and nothing happened with the presidents from the First Republic, because they always received the support of the parliament in Brazil, and they were not judged. And the crimes were very clear, because, for example, it was a very common act in Brazil that time to send people from Rio de Janeiro that were not desired there in Rio de Janeiro, poor people, send them to the Amazon forest. And the Amazon forest in Brazil, First Republic, had nothing of it was nothing. Well, today Brazil it's a country, it has a capital city in the state. Today there are so all the structure that is necessary to live there. But in that time, in Brazilian First Republic, that part of Brazil was almost undiscovered. So it was just the forest, almost just the forest. And send people to there was almost a sentence of death, because those people, they didn't return to the capital, to Rio de Janeiro. They died there because of many diseases, many tropical diseases, because they didn't have money or other conditions to return to their original cities or to the capital, Brazilian capital, for example, Rio de Janeiro. Well, this is just one example, but many people were killed during the travels on the ships that took those people to the Amazon forest. So, and all these things were authorized by the Brazilian government during the First Republic. It means by Brazilian presidents, because they were they had the emergency powers, they had the control of the situation, they were concentrating the powers and concentrating the actions in Brazil during the First Republic. So they knew about all these things that were happening in Brazil because they were authorizing all these things, and nothing happened with them. And until today, one of the things I don't like is that we have many streets, many parks, or many monuments of those presidents from Brazilian First Republic. Mm. But they were so violent, they were unhuman. They killed common people because they knew that nothing would happen to them, and that was what happened. They passed this period with no condemnations, and they are still alive in Brazilian culture, in our daily lives, on the streets, and without we are not criticizing it, we are not discussing this history, we are not reviewing this history, because we are not talking about a dictatorship period, we are talking about a democratic period. Of course, they both are very bad, but well, in dictatorships, the power and the violence is part of the context. We know that the system, a dictator system, is like that. But we don't expect it in a democratic system, in a democratic republic. So we have to ask about it, we have to research about it, we have to identify these aspects in Brazilian history and in other countries too, because we have clear violations of human rights and the other political rights too that were violated in that period because of the state of exception that was manifested by the state of siege in Brazil.
Definitely. I couldn't agree with you more. There is so much work to do with the past and some monuments of impunity that can be in several countries. Well, Antonio, we've taken up a lot of your time. Can you tell us if you are working in any new projects?
I am developing this research about the state of siege, researching about the researching better now the relations about the state of siege in Latin America. So I am emphasizing nowadays the uses and the approaches of the state of siege in the judiciary power and the executive power and the legislative power in some countries, in Argentina, in Chile, in Colombia, and in Brazil, in this research. I am including now these countries, and I am expanding this view of the uses of the state of exception, and specifically the uses of the state of siege, that was the most recurrent and important institute of a state of exception used in Latin America. So I am researching these connections in Latin America among these countries to understand better how it worked and how it developed, and when some countries stopped to use then or preferred to use more or to use less. That's the case of Brazil. After 1930, state of siege was used just twice more. But in other countries in Latin America, it is being used until this decade that ended last year. So some countries chose to continue using this institute. Some countries started late, like Brazil, and stopped early. I am trying to investigate all these connections and how they influenced each other to construct or to develop new laws about it.
That sounds like a very interesting project and a conversation that needs to happen, all of these transnational connections again. Antonio, I want to thank you for being on the show today, talking about Atmósfera de Plomo, las declaraciones de estado de sitio en la Primera República Brasileña. It was a great, great conversation. Take care.
Thank you so much. I'm very glad, as I said, to be here. Thank you for the opportunity. It was a great conversation.
Thank you. And thanks, everybody, for listening to New Books in Latin American Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Until next time. Hasta pronto.